Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Simona Dinnerstein. The internationally acclaimed pianist performs with the Chiara Quartet at the Philadelphia Museum of Art tomorrow. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to a concert by the Philadelphia Singers with the new music ensembles Relâche and Orchestra 2001 and performances by the Choral Arts Society of Philadelphia. Susan Lewis profiles the Delaware Art Museum, which continues a tradition of telling stories through art. And we speak with recent Grammy Award-winning composer Bill Cunliffe. The Temple University Symphony Orchestra gives the world premiere performance of his fourth string La Banda in upcoming concerts at the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia and at Lincoln Center in New York City. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Though she was, by her own admission, a late bloomer, Simona Dinnerstein has become one of classical music's most in-demand pianists since the 2007 release of her debut solo CD, a self-funded recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations. The recording topped the classical Billboard charts. The follow-up, the Berlin Concert, was a live recording of Dinnerstein's recital debut at the Kammermusikal of the Philharmonie in Berlin. She followed that with what would be her final recording for Telarch, the Beethoven Complete Works for Piano and Cello with cellist Zul Bailey. She's now signed to Sony Classical, who will announce her first recording for that label in the coming weeks. Dinnerstein is a regular visitor to Philadelphia, where in the years prior to her career taking off, she was groomed by Astral Artists, the not-for-profit dedicated to nurturing young classical musicians. Simona Dinnerstein performs with the Chiara String Quartet at the Philadelphia Museum of Art tomorrow afternoon at 3. I met with her when she played at the Kimmel Center in February, and first asked her how she's now making decisions about where and what to play.
I'm trying to be smart about the repertoire that I choose. I'm the kind of person that I need to spend a long time on a small amount of music. That's just how I process music. I'm doing two Mozart concertos this year and two Bach concertos. And then I'm doing at the moment this project with the Absolute Ensemble, which is something very different, very funky. And then I'm also playing a recital program with mixed, you know, different music, and then also the Goldberg Variations. So I guess my philosophy is to be playing the music that I want to play and not veering from that.
And if somebody, I don't know, if the Philadelphia Orchestra called and said, we need you to play X, but that wasn't in your head at the time, what would the answer be?
Well, that happened. This past summer I played with the New York Philharmonic, and they asked for Liszt's second piano concerto, which was not in my repertoire, but I wasn't about to say no to the New York Philharmonic. So I did learn that piece, and actually I really enjoyed playing it. It would never in a million years have occurred to me to learn the Liszt second piano concerto, but it's a beautiful piece of music, so I did do that for that occasion. And oddly, I've now played Liszt's first concerto and the Totendanz and the second piano concerto. It was all because of being specifically asked to play that in situations where I didn't want to say no.
When you were thinking about how all of this might be, how was the reality different when it happened from what you imagined it would be?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's something I think about a lot because I feel incredibly fortunate at everything that's happened to me. I mean, I really am living the dream that I had as a child. I mean, even not even as a teenager, but my child's dream of what it meant to be a pianist, which is that I'm traveling all around the world and I'm playing with great orchestras and playing in beautiful concert halls and I'm playing repertoire that I want to play, which is great. But the big fly in the ointment is that I also have a life as a regular person, you know, with my husband and my son, and I like having a normal life, too. I like being at home, and I like being able to, you know, go to museums and go to the botanic gardens and just do things that normal people do and see friends. And that is really difficult to fit in. So the question is, how do you balance all of this, and how do you not feel unhappy with something that should make you incredibly happy, you know? So it's hard to talk about because you don't want to seem like you're ungrateful for what's going on. Of course, I'm incredibly grateful, but at the same time, it is slightly tormenting not to be able to see my family enough.
I would guess that when you were much younger, that what you have now would have appeared ridiculously glamorous, and it's not.
I think if I was a single woman, this could be a very glamorous life. And I could imagine having a lot of fun meeting people all over in different cities. But I'm not a single woman, and therefore I'm not going to be out partying after every concert.
And in a much more practical way, because this happened later to you, it does keep you much more grounded because, you know, we all hear the tales of the prodigious young musicians who in their even teens, but certainly in their early 20s, go off and have this wild life as a concert soloist, and they become unbearable because they don't have anything to ground them.
Right, and also I think that if this happened when you're very young and you just sort of take it all for granted, that could just make you an impossible person to be with, or to, you know, just completely not grounded in any kind of reality. That I feel very aware of the fact that there are many other people that are very deserving of this and don't have it. That it's not happening to them. So I feel that I have also a responsibility that I've been given this opportunity and I need to live up to it and I need to be grateful for it. So I think if this had happened to me when I was 20, I might not have that awareness that this isn't granted to everyone.
And the fact that you had to slog and make it happen for yourself.
Right. I mean, I'm very aware of what it's like for things not to be working out, you know, and I'm sure that it's all very... everything is transitory, and everything could be taken away at any moment. So, you know, you need to enjoy things while they're happening.
Simona Dinnerstein. She performs with the Chiara String Quartet at the Philadelphia Museum of Art tomorrow afternoon at 3.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Out of the not-so-distant yet forgotten past comes two choral programs, respectively by the Philadelphia Singers this evening and the Choral Arts Society next weekend, suggesting that Philadelphia choruses have been more modern than they realized, and getting more so every year. The Philadelphia Singers with Orchestra 2001 and the Relash Ensemble are performing Philip Glass's Persephone for the first time in its vocal version, while the Choral Arts Society has stumbled upon a 20-year-old piece by Philadelphian Joseph Castaldo that seems to have been remarkably ahead of its time. With standard choral works no longer drawing audiences as reliably as they once did, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports on how these longtime singing institutions are rethinking who they are, and even how they sing.
A few notes, repeated hypnotically, implying something far greater than themselves. Mainstream musicians and audiences were more likely to avoid that sort of thing 20 years ago. Not so much now. With the popularity of American minimalists plus the rise of the Baltic composers, often called holy minimalists, we're more comfortable with mystery, glimpses of the unexplainable, and harmonic journeys without the usual conclusions, or perhaps any conventional conclusion at all. At least, that's the hope of the Philadelphia Singers and Choral Arts Society, which are moving towards modern repertoire and way out of their comfort zones. The challenges aren't about hitting the notes, because there aren't that many of them. The music here is titled Ancient Liturgies by the late Joseph Castaldo. The piece explores the murky, secretive world of Mithraism, a late Roman Empire religion that inspired this simple but atmospheric music from a composer better remembered for running the University of the Arts. In this piece, he seems to have been anything but academic, though the music is likely to fall on more sympathetic ears today, in an era that's used to all manner of world music. The performers are struggling to come up with their own understanding of it. To that end, Choral Arts Artistic Director Matt Glandorf has been tossing around all kinds of imagery.
There's one bit where there's sort of a lot of yelling and shouting and rhythm and clapping, and that is where I just sort of say it's very primordial. It should be like you're in a cave and you're hungry. The sopranos are literally just singing five vowels over and over and over and over again. It's just like you're practicing yoga, you're practicing your breathing, and you just go to sort of a different space.
Normally, singers would be encouraged to fall under the music spell. But in a piece that repeats so few notes in a tricky 5/4 time signature, any form of zoning out all but invites a train wreck, even for singers such as Patti McLaughlin, who sang the piece 20 years ago.
I think in a circle for fives, so that because I'm going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so that's how I keep myself in line.
We're after mood, first and foremost. Creating these sort of transcendental effects is what we're really after. It's about engaging the entire body and going from the earthly elements into the realm of the stars. That's what the whole Mithraic religion was about.
Transcendental effects. In the early 20th century, that usually meant composers envisioning some sort of exalted thunderclap experience, the sort that Gustav Mahler described while writing his Symphony No. 8. But that's not what the Philadelphia Singers have been coping with in recent weeks. Philip Glass, and especially Steve Reich, build their transcendental experiences out of tiny rhythmic particles. It's almost a fractal approach towards music that creates a living organism of sound. One of the main differences with the Mahlerian thunderclap and Reich's You Are variations is that the singers, though essential, don't enjoy the usual flagship status. Instead, they're one of several components painstakingly constructed by a composer who strives to induce ecstasy in his listeners, even if that's not how it feels to singers Leslie Johnson and Allison Harvey.
Yeah, I have to say, this is very different than almost anything I've sung chorally before. Well, I hesitate to say ambient, because there's certainly much more to it than that.
It's all mechanistic in a way.
Yeah.
We don't have quite the same freedom vocally to be so expressive. In some ways, we're like electronic instruments being expressive, right. And yet it's so much more just steady, constant sound. Clean and lean is what I keep trying to tell myself.
The paradox is that what's on the page is hugely different from what's heard on stage. Nobody marvels more at this than Philadelphia Singers director David Hayes.
The thing I think is ingenious about the piece is essentially the whole piece for 25 minutes of four movements is in exactly the same tempo. But every single movement feels completely different in terms of how you're experiencing the music and how quickly you feel the time is passing. An enormous amount of shifting meters that you really have to be on top of. There's no option, but you just have to simply nail every bar. It has to be exact. It has to be there. Ultimately, if we find the groove and it sits in the groove, what the people listening to it are going to hear is that it's going to sound joyous and confident, and it's going to sound fun.
Almost behind our backs, the choral music world has slipped into the forefront of progressive music circles. Many of us didn't see that coming. Choral music is often an amateur pursuit in which the new and the challenging don't work so well, with some choruses existing as much for the recreation of the singers as for the pleasure of audiences. Understandably, living composers, even in the recent past, tended to stick with familiar idioms. But there's a color and humanity that comes with massed human voices that forward-looking composers have not been able to resist, particularly the ones who have a lot on their minds. With voices come words and messages, and Reich, for one, has a message of ultimate responsibility. You are what you think. A thought worth repeating, well, often.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Philadelphia Singers performed Glass, Reich, Breyers with Relâche and Orchestra 2001 at the Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts on the University of Pennsylvania's campus this evening at 8. The Choral Arts Society of Philadelphia performs Ancient Liturgies at Dalesford Abbey in Paoli this coming Saturday, and at Philadelphia Cathedral on Chestnut Street in West Philadelphia the day after at 6 p.m. In 1912, the work of American illustrator Howard Pyle became the nucleus of what is now the Delaware Art Museum. Since then, the museum has continued to build upon the theme of storytelling, even as its collection has sprouted in different directions. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the continuing story of the Delaware Art Museum.
Once upon a time, actually in the early days of the 20th century, reading was on the rise, as technology had created more leisure time and electric light by which to read. Books and magazines were often illustrated with original paintings and graphic works. Wilmington native Howard Pyle was a leading illustrator and the first to actually teach illustration. Then, in 1911, Pyle died suddenly at the age of 58. His friends and students banded together to protect and preserve his works. They formed the Wilmington Society for the Fine Arts.
At that point, it was almost entirely his art.
Delaware Art Museum Executive Director Danielle Rice says the collection expanded.
It eventually grew to include the art of his students as well as a library full of illustrated books and archives, his students' notes, for example.
His students included Jesse Wilcox Smith, N.C. Wyeth, and Frank Schoonover, all who lived and worked in the Brandywine Valley. Although illustrations were in demand commercially, Delaware's curator of collections and exhibitions, Mary Hollihan, says they were not particularly valued as fine art.
Often the artists themselves really didn't go to any great length to preserve the work, or it was thrown out by the art editing department.
That, she says, is changing.
From the point of view of the general public and also scholarship. And I think as more illustration is seen, as can be seen here, more and more people will come to realize that it is as valid an art form as what we traditionally consider fine art.
But illustration was not to be the only focus of the museum. In the 1930s, as the country struggled to emerge from the Great Depression, the Wilmington Society of the Fine Arts found itself faced with a large gift and an even bigger challenge. The Bancroft family would donate the sizable Samuel Bancroft collection of pre-Raphaelite art, along with a large tract of land. But, says Danielle Rice, there was a condition.
The requirement was that we build a building. In fact, it was Frank Schoonover, an artist who was very instrumental in leading the charge to raise the money to build the building, which is the brick building with the arches that is still part of the museum complex.
The newly named Delaware Art Center opened in 1938 with an expanded focus. The 19th century pre-Raphaelite artists gave themselves that name because they were looking back in time before the great Renaissance master Raphael, says Mary Hollihan.
They were looking back really toward the late Middle Ages, both for their techniques and for their subject matter, and for what they saw really as their personal virtue, looking at almost a monastic type of morality.
The art, which includes paintings, drawings, prints, decorative arts like stained glass, furniture, and jewelry, also has a literary link.
A number of the pre-Raphaelite artists were illustrators themselves. They were interested in really literary art of all kinds, both ancient, biblical, poetry by Shelley, Tennyson, Keats, and literature of their own time. Dante Gabriel Rossetti did some paintings which were, you might say, actually illustrations of his own poetry.
As the years went by, the museum also increased its holdings of 19th and 20th century artists like Winslow Homer, Edward Hopper, and Andrew Wyeth. In the 1960s, the museum, says Rice, took another giant leap forward.
In 1960, the curator of the museum at the time was working on an exhibition, and he came to know the widow of one of these artists.
The artist, John Sloan, says Mary Hollihan, was known as one of the Ashcan artists.
Sloan and his group originally got that moniker, so to speak, because they were painting works of art not in the refined academic tradition, you know, of genteel interiors, but they were out on the street actually painting what they were seeing there, which often at that time period was pretty grainy and gritty.
Sloan's widow, Helen Farr Sloan, became a dedicated supporter of the museum, even moving to Wilmington in her later years and donating over 3,000 paintings, prints, and drawings by her husband, giving the museum yet another distinctive strength. The museum has continued to grow inside and out, adding an education wing in 1959, an auditorium in 1987, and undergoing more renovation in 2003. As it's filled out its core collection of American art and illustration with 18th, 19th, 20th, and 21st century art, a sculpture garden, and other works, it's taken community requests into consideration about art and even landscaping, says Danielle Rice.
I was approached by a group of women who expressed their interest in having a labyrinth in the museum sculpture garden. Labyrinth is a single circular path into the middle, and then you walk out. And through absolute volunteer effort, the labyrinth came to be, and it's become one of the most popular places in the sculpture garden right now.
The museum has also tapped into technology in its mission to be more than just a place to look at art. It has an interactive website where a child, or even an adult, can create an illustrated story on the computer screen, step by step, using backgrounds and characters which might look familiar to art students or to anyone who's been wandering around the museum.
These are all settings from works in our collection.
Museum Director of Education Courtney Waring rattles off some of the possibilities.
We've got works by Howard Pyle, Edward Hopper, John Sloan, Frederick Edwin Church. Once you have your characters in your setting, you can add props if you want to. Statues, shovels, and these are all objects from works in our collection.
And so the Delaware Art Museum's own story also goes on. With a beautiful setting, passionate characters, and unexpected twists and turns that all seem connected in the end. Or at least the end of this chapter.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Currently on show at the Delaware Museum of Art is Dinotopia, the fantastical art of James Gurney. The show, which includes 60 paintings from Gurney's books, as well as models that detail his creative process, runs through May 16th. Having previously been twice nominated, Bill Cunliffe picked up his first Grammy at a televised ceremony in Los Angeles at the end of January. The award was yet another achievement in the career of the jazz pianist and composer. Over the past three decades, Cunliffe has played with some of the greats, including Buddy Rich, Frank Sinatra, Ray Brown, and James Moody. As a composer, his works have been performed by the Cincinnati Pops and the Illinois Philharmonic, among others. Now resident in California, Cunliffe taught at Temple University's Boyer School of Music during the early 2000s. He returned there this week to work with the Temple University Symphony Orchestra on a piece commissioned for the ensemble and the highly acclaimed trumpeter Terrell Stafford, Temple's Director of Jazz Studies. Fourth Stream La Banda will be premiered at concerts at the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia and at Lincoln Center in New York City. I spoke with Bill Cunliffe earlier this week. Let's start with the title, Fourth Stream La Banda. Please explain.
Yes. Gunther Schuller and John Lewis coined a term, third stream, in the 50s, which was a cross between classical music and jazz. And the piece is actually built on the bass line of a very famous John Lewis piece called Django. I call this fourth stream because I think that Latin and world music and percussion is the fourth stream. So you kind of add that to it. And then La Banda is because the end of the piece, it's kind of not exactly a fight between orchestra and band, but a duel between orchestra and band. And the band wins in the end, but the orchestra joins in and just kind of integrates itself with the band.
It's interesting that you mention all those different influences, because when you were growing up, there was music in the house, but it was principally classical music. Your mother was a pianist.
That's
and
right.
You've also had all these huge Latin influences. You spent time in Brazil and things like that.
That's right.
Do all of these influences live with you every time you sit down to compose?
I think subconsciously they do. I think with a piece like this, what was really fun for me, it was a chance to fuse kind of the three main things that I love, which is Latin music, jazz, and classical music. It was an ability to kind of synthesize all of them and put them into one thing. This piece really is the expression of what I love and enjoy as a performer and as a composer.
I read somewhere that you're more drawn to harmony than melody, but you're a bit of a dab hand at the melody as well.
Well, that's interesting that you read that. I think, you know, I'm English and Scottish and there's some Irish in there. So I've always been really attracted to the English melodists, Holst, Vaughan Williams, Delius, etc. So I think melody comes to me first. I think I'm more of a melodist than a harmonist, because I think that I know when I was in music school, I had melodic things that I wanted to do, but then when I found more things out about harmony, I was able to kind of integrate those in. And I would also say that the reason I playing piano and clarinet, and the reason I pick piano is that you can play more than one note at a time.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I am a harmony guy after all.
When you're given a commission, where does it start? Have you got a piece of melody in your head, or do you have a sort of an intellectual outline?
Well, I had the idea to do this piece many years ago because I always thought that I love the piece Django, and I love the idea of a jazz composer playing a classical sounding piece. Django starts out sounding like classical, but then it goes into jazz. So I thought this is the perfect way to kind of integrate the two and then overlay the Latin element on top of that. And Terrell is the perfect guy for that. A, very fine classical trumpet player. B, a world-class jazz player, that goes without saying. And thirdly, he understands Latin music really, really well. He's got a real intuition for it. We had our first run-through yesterday, and he actually gave me a few suggestions. And I'm over your spring break, I'm going to furiously rewrite the last few bars to give it that pop, that real ultimate thing that you want at the end of a piece.
Are there certain technical, musical things that you need to be aware of the abilities of the players before you sit down to write it?
I think that Ellington was the prime example of you have a band and then you write for who's in the band. And I think that all composers to a certain level do that. Brahms enlisted Joseph Joachim to help him with the violin concerto. I think the player is intimately involved in the piece, and I think that to a degree, if the player is involved in the composition in terms of some sort of basic technical musical schema, I think the better the piece will be.
Before you made the decision to become a professional musician, I think you were majoring in psychology, am I correct?
That's right.
And then you decided to become a professional musician.
Yeah.
Do you think that you would be making that decision if you were now one of your students? Because it's not getting any easier.
No. I think I would make the same decision. But I would say right now, it's a little tougher for these kids than it was for me, for a couple of reasons. Being the golden age of the music that we love is from the 1940s to the 60s, because the jazz, in terms of swing music, had essentially, in the 1940s, 80% of the popular music sold
in America.
It was
the popular music of the day, yeah.
Exactly. And that residual effect allowed bebop to flourish, because the best of the most successful Miles Davis, John Coltrane music, Stan Getz, that music was close enough to the popular music of the day that it was accepted readily by the people. By the time we got into the late 60s, no longer the case. Jazz had to change, and Miles Davis, through Bitches Brew, gave jazz kind of a new leg to stand on. Right now, the popular music of our day and jazz, the intersection is a little tougher to find, number one. Number two, the whole idea of getting people to pay for content is in tatters. And that combined with a rather substantial economic downturn. So we've got three things going on right now that make it tougher for young people. I feel sorry for them. But I think that all economic times get better. People do adjust. The musical training that kids are getting is very, very good, at least at the upper echelon. I mean, Temple is just a wonderful school, and the level of the students now is even higher than when I was here.
Finally, if there is a Bud Powell or a John Coltrane or a Bill Conliff enrolled in Temple's music school today, will that person become all they could be? Where is he going to be in 10 years?
He'll do just fine. He'll probably be a little more multimedia and bifurcated and diverse. He'll be playing, he'll be promoting his own concerts, he'll be composing, he'll probably be teaching a little bit, he'll probably be writing film scores, he'll be accompanying singers. He'll do okay. Music isn't going to go away.
Pianist and composer Bill Conliff. The Temple University Symphony Orchestra will premiere his fourth stream, La Banda, at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Sunday, March 21st at 3, and at Alice Tully Hall at Lincoln Center on Friday, April 9th at 8. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under their music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.